Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Every week, we want to have honest conversations about what it means to be in one of the sector's least understood, yet most critical roles. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to remind everyone that my four fundraising frameworks are available to your organization. All you've got to do is go to my website, click on the toolbox, and download this free resource. Inside the toolbox, you'll find four frameworks, 1, 2, 3, 4, that will help your organization ensure that everyone understands how fundraising really works. Not quite so sure what I'm talking about, you will have a framework for distinguishing between fundraising cultures, a planning framework that ensures your fundraising efforts are responsive to the opportunities available to your organization, a campaign planning framework for any major fundraising initiative, and as if that's not enough, how about a KPI scorecard that combines my fascination with the science of expertise with your determination to raise more money? If you'd like to download this free resource, go to my website, lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. Again, that's lewisfundraising.com/toolbox. I'll also put a link in the show notes. Without further ado, I do want to introduce my guest today. Hi, David. Would you mind just introducing yourself to my listeners?
Hi, Jason. Thanks very much for having me. My name is David Burgess. I'm a fundraising consultant here in the UK. I run a company called Apollo Fundraising, and we specialize in helping arts, culture, and heritage charities to raise money.
So, David, I have been to lots of fundraising conferences and lots of fundraising conferences here in the U.S., but I have never been to the one over there in the U.K., over in Europe. But you were at that conference earlier this week, and I'm sort of envious because I'm hoping that maybe they do better conferences. So tell me a little bit about the conference earlier this week.
Yeah, it's been a great 3 days at the Institute of Fundraising's National Convention here in London at the Barbican. And it's just a wonderful chance to meet somewhere in the region of 3,000 fundraisers working across a real variety of causes and talking on a real range of topics. It is a real great mix, and it's nice for me as a consultant to sit back, to reflect, to listen to what other people are finding there on the coalface and just reflect on my own practice and how I can then use that to help our clients and customers.
Wow. So the 3,000 attendees, I think AFP here, when they do the international conference, usually gets, I don't know, 4,000 people. But I have to imagine you guys are getting just everyone else. Am I right? that's a remarkable, you've got to have people coming from around the world. Am I right?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously a large number from across the UK, but yeah, definitely international speakers and delegates as well. And probably some familiar faces you'll have seen at AFP, both speaking and kind of hovering around as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So is it Dave or David? Make sure I got that right.
I use both, but David generally in a fundraising sense.
Okay, David. I'm delighted to have you on here today. One of the things that sort of caught my interest was a couple of weeks ago, I caught this headline, Charities Urge to Drop the Outdated Requirements for Employees to Have Degrees. And there was some conversation on social media. So I reached out to you and said, hey, let's talk about this. And you said, hey, let's do that. So let's sort of sum it up for me real quick, and then we'll talk about what the campaign's all about.
Okay, so it started when I was looking through a couple of job descriptions as part of a consultancy project, And it just suddenly struck me for the first time how many were asking for a degree-level education. Didn't really matter what subject it was in. They just wanted to know that you'd been to university. And at a time when the fundraising profession, certainly here in the UK, is facing a huge range of challenges around equality, diversity, and inclusion, this seemed a really kind of unhelpful thing to have in job descriptions, a real sort of no entry sign to people that either through choice or through circumstance hadn't gone to university. And it just seemed really strange that we would block off what here in the UK works out as about being 70% of the population from even considering a job in fundraising and contributing to that quite narrow view when you look at the type of people that are in the room when you go to conferences like the IOF convention this week. So the more we started talking to charities and to recruiters who were including this in job descriptions, we started finding actually people didn't really know why it was there. They were including it because it had always been there in their job descriptions, and no one had really thought, well, what's that for? Why is that helpful to us? Why are we saying that's an essential thing for our fundraisers to have? It didn't really start as a campaign. It started as me sort of angrily tweeting away. But off the back of that, I was sort of blown away by the number of people who came forward, both saying, yeah, this is a really important issue. Why are we still doing this? But also from some really talented fundraisers, some incredible fundraisers coming forward saying, yeah, that's put me off going for jobs in the past, or that meant I couldn't go for what I saw as a dream job. These people who face that barrier just because, yeah, earlier in their life they'd, for whatever reason, not been to university.
Yeah, so and maybe this is what you would sort of summarize it using in your own language, but one of the things that people oftentimes hear me, David, referring to the fundraising profession as sort of being in its messy adolescence. And I think it's sort of working its way as the profession becomes a much more legitimate career path and as opportunities sort of expand globally around the world. I think it's just sort of working, and I have to imagine, and if you think about adolescence in the context of what when we're in that sort of messy teenage years, sort of phase of life, there's things that we sort of carry with us and those assumptions that maybe aren't necessarily as sound and well informed. And I have to imagine that maybe this is one of them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, and I think that's right. I think perhaps people saw it as serving a purpose when they were first setting out. Some people have said, well, perhaps it's being used as a proxy for some of the other skills that fundraisers need, and things like the ability to research and to turn that knowledge into a more digestible format. Some people look at it as a proxy for being able to learn quite quickly or learn on the job. And I think that's absolutely true. I think a lot of graduate courses do give you those skills, or at least help you to demonstrate those skills. I think the key point for the campaign is to say that's not the only way. It's not just people that come out of university that are able to communicate well. In fact, I've spent quite a lot of time over the last few weeks reviewing foundation proposals, and so many of them come across as if they've been written by an academic trying to write a dissertation or an academic paper. And you want to scream out and say, talk to me like a human being. Come show me the passion of the work. Stop trying to just get across the cold science of what you're doing. So I think looking at the fact and accepting the fact, okay, yes, going to university is one way of getting those skills, but let's start looking at some of the other ways people could demonstrate they've got those base skills to make a really great fundraiser.
Yeah, but you sort of point out one of the weaknesses in the way all this usually plays out is usually it's not a fundraiser writing that job description. And so it's oftentimes someone who does have some form of credentialing, some sort of education in their own field. Certainly in academia, you've got people who spent large portions of their early life getting, quote unquote, qualified for the work that they do. And so it's probably just they may not even think about it a whole lot. It's just sort of assumed that anyone in this, you know, in professional work ought to have this particular credential or this particular degree. You know, David, one of the things that I have in my first book, and I'm working on my second one now, and one of the things that I talked about in there was this idea that, which loops to the idea of what the, you know, so if you have to have a degree, what degree should you have? I think some of the baggage that comes along with, say, marketing or PR or advertising backgrounds and you know, credentials of those sorts actually doesn't serve us very well. You know, fundraising is so many different things. And so what that particular education is, can be kind of problematic if it sort of boxes you in and narrows your understanding of what it is you're doing.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, going back to the point around job descriptions not being written by fundraisers, I mean, I think the first point is, I mean, that's it sort of shows the privilege there that you can assume that other people have the same background as you if you went to university. And we talked about privilege quite a lot at the IOF convention this week, and it can be quite difficult to see your own privilege if you've had those opportunities. But I think actually for a lot of small shop fundraising departments, actually it quite often is the fundraiser that's writing those job descriptions. If your not-for-profit only has a few members of staff, you might not have that HR specialist.
Yeah.
And I think this is where one of the challenges comes in. In that situation, more often than not, the fundraiser will turn to the previous job description and just look at what's gone before and just do a copy and paste job and think, well, if it was good enough then, surely that'll be good enough now. To come to the point about what other skills fundraisers should have,
yeah,
I think part of it is realizing that not everyone can have all those skills. And actually, I think that's where some of the best teams come in, is where you have a real diversity across the people working together. We've been really lucky at convention to hear from some fantastic storytellers who wouldn't describe themselves as fundraisers and don't work as fundraisers on a day-to-day basis, but held a room of 2,500 people in absolute, who are absolutely mesmerized by the stories they were telling. And if you couple that ability to tell that compelling story with someone who understands how DM works, or someone who understands how the Trust and Foundation side works, how corporates work, working together, bringing those complementary skills together, you can end up with a really powerful fundraising team. And I think the danger is more often than not, we try and recruit in our own image. We look for people like us, or we look for people that are a direct clone of the person we're trying to replace. And we lose that diversity within our teams. We lose that. And we lose the excitement that comes when you have people with different perspectives, different understandings, bringing a different skill set together.
So I have to think that the other, because I saw someone else talking about, I saw someone talking about hiring challenges here recently on social media and fundraisers not getting hired. And I have to imagine that the other barrier that a lot of us are encountering when we're on the job market is it just comes down to dollars and cents. You know, how much money have you raised? So how do you balance, like, what is it, David, that you're actually looking for on that resume, on that sort of demonstration of experience, if you're not saying that I have achieved this level of academic training and I have or have not raised this amount of funds? Are we just looking for friendly, outgoing people, or what is it that we're looking for?
I think that's going to change organization to organization and role to role. So the real thing we're trying to encourage organizations to do is to think beyond that degree and say, what are the skills? What knowledge are we looking for? What experiences are we looking for that are actually going to enable someone to do this job, both in terms of the role and in terms of how that role fits within the wider team? So what skills, what knowledge, what experience are missing from the wider team as well? And that is going to change place to place, but it's getting people to think much more clearly about what are we actually looking for, and what are we actually going to judge people on when those proposals come in? Because I think one of the things that has come out a lot even from organizations that are asking for a degree level qualification, is that they're not actually looking for that when the CV comes in. You know, people were saying, I've just realized this has been on our job descriptions for the last 5 years. I've not once actually checked the paperwork or checked that that was there on the CV. For some, that's going to be quite an easy change because their job descriptions already spell out in quite a high level of detail the skills, knowledge, and experience they're looking for. It's going to take,
Yeah, so David, you work with your client. You do consulting, right? That's what I understand. So you have to have clients, for example, or if you had a client that was in higher education, especially if we're doing donor facing, just sort of playing the devil's advocate here. If I'm working with a client that's a, you know, institute of higher learning, and my donors are, the large majority of my donors are highly educated people, I can see the difficulty of putting a major gift officer in front of them, a major donor, for example, who doesn't have some degree of higher learning themselves, or at least can sort of demonstrate a capacity to interact and relate and all those sorts of things. I mean, there's a reason why universities, for example, hire their own people, because it allows them to connect well and relate and develop rapport really quickly with their donors. So what do you say to that client who's saying, okay, I'll overlook the fact that they don't have this particular academic background, but they've got to know how to relate to my donors?
Well, I think it's being clear that that is actually what you're looking for. So as you say, it's not the unspecified degree qualification. It's that shared connection that donor's going to have.
Right.
So I think being clear about that is the first step. Then I think it comes down to that personal view as to whether you need a direct lived experience of the cause you're fundraising for to be a good fundraiser for that cause. So some universities, I think, will absolutely have that feel that you have to be, you have to have gone through that process to know what going to university is like to be effective. But I'm not sure that's true. My personal feeling is that's not the case. Do you have to have been a cancer survivor to fundraise for a cancer research charity? Do you have to have been a leading opera singer to be able to fundraise for an opera house? Yeah. And if that's the case, by the time we start getting to dogs and cats charities, we're in real trouble.
Right. David, let me before. I mean, you're going down the passion. You're heading down the passion path where you get to that. I remember I was interviewed for a job. I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago, was with a literacy organization, and she wanted to know if I was passionate about literacy. And I said, no, I'm not really. I really like to raise money, and I'm quite good at it, and I do know how to read. But I didn't get the gig because, you know, I wasn't. And I actually, I'm quite a reader, but, literacy just wasn't my thing. And so I disqualified myself in a matter of, I think, 2 or 3 minutes.
Sorry about that. Isn't it? And it's something I've been sort of thinking about quite a lot recently, and I think my view has changed slightly. I've always thought this might be one area where fundraising in the arts and culture sector is different to the rest of the sector, because the donors bring with them a very different level of understanding of the work. Most donors to theatres or opera companies, someone described it at IOF this week, as having an encyclopedic knowledge of that art form. They remember every production they've seen since 1960, whatever. They remember all the singers, all the actors, all the and all the rest of it. And so they have a slightly different relationship with the cause. And often, as you said, in the case of the higher education example just now, they are looking for someone to connect on that level.
Yeah.
So I have often looked at passion for the cause as being quite an important attribute for someone. But Ian McQuillan, I was chatting quite a lot with Ian over the last few days, and he made the really great point that actually our passions change all the time. And sometimes it's having that chance to be exposed to something that helps you develop that passion. So I think more and more I'm looking at that and thinking, is that as important as I've often thought? And if it's not, again, how do we get around that, that building rapport? I think it's something that I'm going to keep sort of mulling over, and I suspect my opinion on that will change many times.
So before I let you go, let's pick on Ian for a moment. I think he can handle it. So Ian's one of those guys that, you know, he stirs up a lot of thoughts and ideas on the Rogeri site. And, I think that's actually how you and I connected. But Ian's also one of the first guys who will, declare himself in a lot of the conversations. He'll say, I'm not a fundraiser. Which is sort of an interesting sort of spin on this conversation so what sort of qualifies us to sort of contribute to the conversation? And it kind of gets back to that idea of, do you have to be a cancer survivor to have something to say about cancer, or to raise money for cancer? And do you have to be a fundraiser to have anything to say about fundraising? You know, Ian's a guy who's, you know, doing deep dives into a lot of very thoughtful things. But I have seen myself as I'm reading his commentary sort of on where the fundraising profession is going. I've seen myself, and I think I've seen others sort of step back and think, well, does he really know what he's talking about? 'Cause he's not a fundraiser. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there are a few comments, to Ian's piece that sort of picked up on that. And I think, I don't think that invalidates Ian's opinion. And in fact, I think it enables Ian to stand and look at things from a different perspective and call out things that other people won't necessarily have seen or thought about. I mean, I think the thing that Ian does really well is he gets us to challenge the assumptions that we make when we're making decisions. And I think some of the responses to Ian's piece, I think, absolutely reflect that people are viewing it from a different perspective and with a different level of assumption based on being on the front line as fundraisers or having recruited people. So I must admit, I think that when I first read Ian's piece, it came as perhaps a bit of a shock. It was the first time anyone had sort of pushed back on the campaign, but I've really appreciated the level of insight and that different perspective that Ian's brought. I mean, I think it would be easy to dismiss it as saying, oh, he's being hugely critical. And actually, he doesn't. He spends a lot of time really thinking about the different angles on things, the different assumptions that might be going on. And as a result of the conversations I've had with Ian, both online and in person over the last couple of days, it has sort of shone a different light on things and given me things to think about, to go and research a bit more, and different people to talk to get those different perspectives. I think it's important to have voices like Ian's in the sector, and that's true of all the team at Rogeri.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, any profession, any sort of line of work deserves its those who will look at things critically and ask the right questions. I think that's one of my critiques, and I think I've shared this with Ian and some others, and I've certainly shared this with my guest here on the podcast, is that I don't think those of us Americans who sort of think that we're the guardians of what good fundraising practice is are particularly good at getting pushback and asking some tough questions about the practices that we've heralded as the way to do things. So I think you guys on the other side of the Atlantic have demonstrated Rogeri being one of the sort of the drivers behind that, have demonstrated that that maybe asking some critical questions every once in a while can be quite productive in moving the needle on this a little bit.
I don't think Ian and I we probably won't ever see completely eye to eye on the level of training qualification needed to become a fundraiser, but I think through sharing those differences, through talking through them, as I say, certainly I found that a very interesting, very thought-provoking conversation to have.
So David, before I let you go, what has been the response from those of us over here in the U.S.? Have you gotten any response? Have you gotten any feedback? Or is this largely happening over there where you're at?
I think it's largely been here in the UK, I think partly because of the timing. The campaign comes at a time where over here in the UK, we're putting a lot of thought and effort into looking at equality, diversity and inclusion within the fundraising profession. So on Wednesday this week, the IOF, the Institute of Fundraising, launched their new strategy for equality, diversity and inclusion. And I think that the campaign sort of fits alongside that. So it feels very timely here. There hasn't really been that much interaction yet from the States. And it'd be really interesting to hear whether the challenges we're facing here in the UK resonate with fundraisers in the States and to the extent they see this as being a problem and something that we can do something about to remove some of those barriers that might be stopping talented fundraisers from entering the profession.
You know, you've got me thinking. I think you mentioned that before we hit the record button, that this has a lot to do with that there's obviously the aim of addressing some diversity and inclusion issues. But this is sort of a like an indirect approach. This isn't, and maybe that's the some of us, because there's certainly within the conversation that we're having here in the U.S. when it comes to fundraising, there's certainly a lot of diversity and inclusion conversation going on, but it's much more direct. I don't know that they're talking about academic requirements on, you know, educational requirements on job descriptions, but maybe it'll be interesting to see if you guys can sort of pick up the pace quicker on this because you don't take as direct an approach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, as we were saying before, I think this is one strand. I don't think the campaign on its own is going to completely solve the problem. I don't think it's a silver bullet in that way. But it does feel like something that can have an impact. The report from the IOF this week showing 91% of fundraisers here in the UK are white, only 3% with a disability, 4% identifying as LGBTQ+. And if you look at that against the characteristics of graduates, the same challenges are coming out from higher education as we're seeing in the fundraising profession. And it seems that the more we prioritize and sort of only look to the university sector for recruiting our fundraisers, all we're doing is inheriting the equality and diversity challenges that they're facing at that ground level into the fundraising profession. So as I say, I think this is one thing that we're trying to achieve, but it sits within a much bigger strategy of conversations and a longer term strategy that the IOF has to really try and move the needle on equality, diversity and inclusion and address some of these challenges that we face as a sector.
So, David, if somebody's listening and they're thinking, okay, I know how to get in touch with Jason, but I'd really like to reach out to David, how might you suggest that they do that?
So you can reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at David Burgess FR. And you can try following the non-graduates welcome hashtag. So if you put hashtag non-graduates welcome, you can see some of the stories from fundraisers across the UK here and the challenges they've faced and people talking about this issue. And if you want to, you can go to my website. I've got a blog there with various resources and articles, which is apollofundraising.com.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.